Hi, I'm Sophie, and you're listening to Navigating New York, a podcast where I chat with people living and working in one of the most fast-paced cities in the world. Through these conversations, I hope to make living in the Big Apple a little less overwhelming. As the song goes, if you can make it here, you'll make it anywhere. So whether you're living here now, planning to move, or just interested in hearing real stories from people pursuing that American dream, I hope that you enjoy. On this episode, I speak to Dr. Gillian O'Shea Brown, who I'm lucky to call a dear friend. Dr. Jill is a psychotherapist, complex trauma specialist, and EMDRIA approved consultant. She's also an adjunct professor of trauma at NYU. Dr. Jill's in-depth knowledge of trauma has been featured multiple times in Vogue and various other high-profile publications. She is author of the book Healing Complex Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and has another book coming very soon. Dr. Jill hails from County Cork in Ireland, and her journey in the US is a fascinating one. To me, Jill is not only an expert in her field of therapy, but she's also a model of what following your heart and working extremely hard can lead to. Dr. Jill's Instagram page is probably the page I visit most across all social media. Every piece of advice or knowledge she shares is deeply enlightening, carefully guiding people through understanding, treating, and healing from the wounds of complex trauma. Our conversation covers many aspects and types of trauma, but Dr. Jill also weaves in many beneficial and accessible modes for healing. I consider myself so lucky to have Jill as a friend in my life, and I highly recommend following her online, signing up to her free newsletter, and sharing her helpful tips with people you care about. Her website is drgillianosheabrown.com, and you can find her on Instagram at drgillianosheabrown. This episode is kindly sponsored by Therapy Clinic, Europe's number one med spa that has just opened in New York City. Therapy is an Irish family-run business. They have over 70 clinics in Europe and have a gorgeous home here in Manhattan on 19th Street, with more locations opening soon. Find them on Instagram at therapyclinic_USA, and you can get a complimentary underarm treatment by quoting Navigating New York when you book in. I hope you enjoy this episode. Jill, thank you so much for being a guest on Navigating New York. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a long-term fan of this podcast and of you. I just think you're such a wonderful storyteller. And I think you're doing a very important job of reshaping people's views of Irish immigrants. There's been so many stories of triumph over adversity and growth and creativity in this podcast that it's just so important in terms of shaping Irish culture. So thank you.
Oh, Jill, you're going to get me emotional before we even start. Thank you so much. And today the storytelling is all coming from you. And I'm so, so honored to have you as a guest. You know how much I admire you and how much you inspire and help me. And I just can't wait to share your message with our listeners. So delighted to have you on. And well, let's just dive in, and I'll have you sort of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you ended up here in New York from Cork in Ireland.
Wow. Okay. So I grew up in Cork. I went to college in UCC, and I was very lucky because I met really lovely friends that are a big part of my life now, even though I'm so far away. And they really are forever friends. And while I was in UCC, I did do a J1 in Ocean City. And I remember all of us sitting around a table, kind of thinking, where will we go? And we were looking at different beaches. And then we saw the words ocean and a city. And we thought, you know, what more could you ask for? It's kind of got everything. And we called ourselves Oceans 14 at the time. Yeah. Three of us headed off. And I'll be honest, you know, that summer in America was just wild and fun and catastrophic and crazy. And I kind of thought, wow, I think I've had enough of America. I don't think I'll go back at the time. And I ended up in Wicklow and South Dublin working with what was the HSE at the time. And now it's TUSLA. And I was working in child protection. And while I was working in child protection, there were forensic style interviews for survivors of recent and retrospective disclosures of child sexual abuse. And it was really, really difficult work because you were coming head to head with actively unfolding trauma day to day. And I noticed in doing that work that there was a huge difference between the child that was harmed and came home and made a disclosure and they were immediately compassionately witnessed versus the person that would come in and make a disclosure from 20 years ago, something that there was a lot of secrecy, shame and silence around that they had carried on the inside for a long time. Maybe they had spent a lot of their life numbing that pain or ignoring that pain or disconnecting from others and trying to make themselves smaller, maybe even punishing themselves in different ways. And there was a lot of times in that work where after getting, you know, the full story, writing up the reports, and then it would go to the legal process, which I wasn't part of, where, you know, the client would turn to me and say, because we talk about aftercare and I'd suggest therapy, and they would say, you know, will you be my therapist? And I wasn't qualified or licensed in Ireland at that time. And it would really break my heart because it takes a lot to take the walk with someone and have them tell their story in great detail. And that level of emotional intimacy and attunement and resonance, it kind of shapes you. And from there, I decided, you know, I need to find a way of creating a toolbox of taking away the burden of this unspoken trauma. So I had met my husband in Ocean City a few years previous, and I came to the US and I had a brief stint in the hospital system, and I decided this is not my cup of tea. And I think we've all had a job like that where you get there and you're so excited and you kind of think, actually, this is not the career path for me. I need to go within and choose again. So I decided to qualify in an integrative trauma program at the National Institute of Psychotherapies and really, you know, get deep into this trauma healing process and learn, you know, how unspoken, unhealed trauma wounds impact the body, the mind, the whole person as they move through the world. And in the interim, I kind of started my own private practice. I started doing the deeper work with clients. And not satisfied with that, I decided to go to NYU and pursue a doctorate. And I only wanted to study one thing. Oh, I was a very difficult student. I only wanted to study about relational trauma because I realized from hearing people's stories that the deepest wounds, the deepest pain came from their experiences and close relationships. You know, what happened too much, what didn't happen enough, or, you know, what they ached for. And I realized that most of the pain, the wounds, they happen in these early formative relationships. So while in NYU, I did my doctoral research on complex trauma. And luckily for me, they invited me to turn that into a book. And now the book is a course that I teach at NYU. And I still teach and maintain my private practice. And that's kind of how I ended up in New York.
Wow, Jill, thank you so much for such a lovely summary of what has been an incredible journey. And I think what really comes across when you speak about what you do is your passion and love for it. And I love how you sort of admitted that, like, you had went in a direction with the hospital system and, you know, figured out very, you know, soon that it wasn't for you and we can choose again. And I think that's really important as we navigate our lives, no matter what stage we're at. So for you to have come to New York, went to NYU, and to have really honed in on what it is that you wanted to learn more about and then subsequently share with people and clients and help people is just super inspiring. And what stands out to me is that you, as a psychotherapist with such a vast passion for helping people who've suffered trauma, you said that you compassionately witness them and you take the walk with them. And I wonder, for listeners especially, it's something that perhaps growing up we're quite foreign to, that sort of experience of sharing our deepest, darkest kind of shameful memories. How important is it in the process of healing for people to go and speak to a therapist and open up those kind of those wounds and really do the work?
That's actually a very beautiful question, and it's a really important question. And it makes me think of a quote from Peter Levine And he says, trauma is not what happens to you. It's what you carry in the inside in the absence of a compassionate witness. And there are some events in life that are just so painful and so earth-shattering. And the silence, the secrecy, and the shame, it locks it inside. And, you know, you feel heavier physically and you make a meaning of that event, a story you start to tell yourself about yourself and about the world. And sometimes that story is I'm unlovable or I'm not in control, I'm powerless, I'm a failure, I'm not good enough. And then those beliefs shape your behaviors and how you move through the world and your decisions. And if you keep walking around in this state of hypnosis, and if you keep telling yourself the same story, it never really gets interrupted. And what I think is very sad about that is that the true essence of the person is lost. It's masked by fear and defense mechanisms, and they never really get the opportunity to come home to themselves. So a lot of the time in therapy, for me, I feel a little bit like a sculptor, you know, Michelangelo carved the David, and you were in Italy recently, so maybe you visited him. And he said, you know, the angel was always in the marble and I carved until I set it free. And I often feel that way, you know, person comes in and first they're fine and grand. If they're Irish, they're fine and grand. And there's maybe a few little things. And then they start disclosing, you know, their defense mechanisms, their beliefs, and the memories that underpin them, because they're all learned through painful life experiences. And then as we process them together, the meaning they made of the memory at the time starts to shift. And then a beautiful process starts to happen where when they forgive themselves or they unburden or the meaning they make of it starts to shift, you see they start to look different. They start to act different. Their decisions are different. Their decisions about romantic partners, family, friends, bold career decisions, they become more creative and compassionate and calm and connected with themselves and with others. And it's lovely because you feel like that is who they always were. And that's not to say that pain, adversity, and trauma, you know, forever marks or masks your identity, because there is a concept called post-traumatic growth. And we've all heard of post-traumatic stress, but post-traumatic growth is the wisdom that you have to develop in order to navigate painful life experiences. And you often hear trauma survivors say, because I went through this, I have a deeper level of compassion and understanding. Or because I navigated this painful life event, I trust myself and I know if I can get you this, I can get you anything. Actually, my trauma survivor clients in the midst of the pandemic, a lot of them said, you know, I've been through a lot worse than this. You know, this is going to be, I know that I can get through this, mm-hmm. You know, because that struggle and that triumph over adversity had given them an inner trust. So not only are you navigating the post-traumatic stress, you're identifying the growth, the wisdom, and there is sometimes gifts that come with the pain. It's just really hard to see them initially.
That's so interesting. And I think that's something that I really admire about your work and how you share these learnings, because I think really, isn't that what we are all capable of, is learning things differently, learning to think about ourselves differently. And your Instagram posts for me are just, it's so enlightening, because I think that because we are not therapists, like the average person isn't as aware of their emotions or their core beliefs as we should be, that you allow with your, you know, very simple and perfect captions, you sort of explain some things that I sit back and we can be like, right, I understand now. And one of those for me is what you just mentioned, is negative core beliefs. And as well as that, then our defense mechanisms that often come up. And I heard you on another podcast talking about some of those defense mechanisms might be overworking, might be, you know, kind of numbing out on the couch, eating comfort food, might be sort of, you know, engaging in risky sort of destructive behaviors. And really, I think that one of the most powerful tools we can have as we are healing, because I think really essentially all of us are healing from something, and we can talk, I can't wait to talk about inner child work with you, but you know, that to notice these things and for you to educate people on that, it makes people sit back and just nod and say, right, I understand my behaviors and I understand where this sort of negative core belief may have come from as a younger version of myself.
You're so right. And thank you for all the kind words. And I just want to caveat with some of the most healing and empowering conversations I've had in my whole life have not been with a therapist. They've been with an emotionally intelligent, warm, caring, compassionate friend, you know, and for people to tap into their own internal healing wisdom. It doesn't take a qualification in psychotherapy. It just takes some healthy curiosity. And as you said, you know, identifying your core beliefs, tying them to the memories of when they were born. When that happens in therapy, I love when people say, oh, I understand now, or I have a deeper understanding of myself. And that sense of understanding and knowing that behind every behavior is a feeling and behind every feeling is a need. And even if some of these behaviors are out of alignment with your compelling future template or your North Star, you can understand, oh, I do this to feel comfortable, or I do this to protect myself, or I do this because it's familiar. And that deeper understanding allows people to have a relationship with themselves that's much more harmonious. And then they can negotiate with their defense mechanisms, and they can have more power and control to designing a life in a very intentional way.
I love that. It's enlightening to hear it, that just being open and having those conversations with a compassionate person. And obviously, I mean, I said previously that we're all healing, but I don't want to underestimate that, you know, there are certainly clients of yours who have suffered grave trauma, and you have these incredible methods to help different versions of trauma. But I guess what I identify with in the things that you share is that we are in a different time than both in the world and in our own lives than when we were children, and how we communicate and how we can talk about our own mental health. We can't do that as a child, and we can't process what's happening around us at that stage. And I think as we get older, it's important to sort of not separate the us now from the younger version, but to, you know, be compassionate with our inner child. And do you find that inner child work is something that, you know, helps people sort of go through trauma and come out with more compassion for themselves?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, in terms of what you opened up with there, in terms of some people have big T traumas, you know, the kind of traumas where you're thinking, wow, that was an earth-shattering event. And some people, it's the death by a thousand cuts, and it's the meaning they made of it and the story they told themselves. And it's actually, you know, it's a very Irish mentality. Oh, I can't complain because it could be a lot worse. And look at this person down, Mary down the road, and John over there, and I can't complain. But actually, you know, trauma leaves behind clues. And when you look at the clues, you know, what's happening in your body, in your life, your defense mechanisms, in your thoughts that are blockages, and you can always tail them back to key traumatic events. And in my opinion, the definition of trauma is when your past intrudes upon your present. And in all trauma healing, you have one foot in the present and one foot in the past, and you're compassionately witnessing your earlier self from a place of safety, whether that's you as a kid, or whether that's you as a teenager, or in your early adult years, or at another time. You end up with multiple versions of yourself across time. And what actually happens with people is there are events in life that are so painful that a part of you gets stuck in that painful time and place. And these are called frozen ego states or self states. We all have different parts of self, and we all have a mosaic mind. And when something happens, you know, one part of you might feel mad, another part might feel sad. One part of you wants to go to therapy and process, another part of you doesn't want to go there, doesn't want to go into the past. One part of you might want to date and connect and meet people, and the other part might be deathly afraid of everything that goes with intimacy. So there can be these internal conflicts that arise, and, you know, working with your different parts of self, whether they're younger parts or defense mechanisms or numbing destructive parts, distracting parts, it can be really helpful. And all of those parts are underpinned by memories and moments where they were born. So it's really hard to do trauma work without meeting the wounded inner child. angry teenager or the early adult that lost her confidence because choices she made put her in unsafe situations. And you'll always, you know, as you peel back the layers, you'll uncover these past moments where you, your identity was frozen in time. And a part of you just was so, the emotions, the silence, the secrecy, the shame were so potent that you got stuck. And when you meet and compassionately witness and rescue and affirm those earlier parts, they start to grow and evolve, and then you fluidly move forward together. So you're totally right in what you're saying. In the context of trauma work, you know, where the past is intruding on the present, you're always going to have to go back to that past self, compassionately witness them and guide them. And what's really nice with most of the trauma modalities, whether it's somatic experiencing or EMDR or internal family systems, what they all do is they all allow you to tap into your innate healing wisdom. So the client becomes their own guide to healing.
That is so interesting that, you know, somebody might come to you feeling at their weakest and, you know, so vulnerable, and that it really is an opportunity to sort of fill our toolbox with, you know, those tools that we need to look at ourselves with compassion and our, and the things that happened to us, and connect them with the behaviors, the way we look and think about ourselves, you know, in the world today. And I think that the way that you share that is so, it's so powerful for a vast amount of people. Honestly, really, Jill, before I met you and we did our yoga teacher training together, I think I didn't have this level of understanding, because you put it so perfectly, you put it quite simply. And it's so great that you're able to empower people to be the healers themselves. And I just think that work is, it's just incredible. And I think that at the moment, I find in the world that we live in, we're kind of constantly being fed this sort of lifestyle and self-help advice. And I think it's obviously very helpful in certain cases, but I do think it can be a little bit overwhelming. And, you know, sometimes we don't, maybe if we're feeling a little bit stuck, it's hard to know where to start in that healing journey. Do you have any sort of tips on how to help people feel connected to themselves and learn to operate with more self-awareness, like more sort of general tips for day-to-day kind of living to help get to that state of more contentment?
Well, that's a really helpful question for your listeners. And it's a really great question. And a lot of trauma survivors, because if you think about the symptoms of trauma, the emotional reactivity, the numbing, the intrusive thoughts, the flashbacks, the shame-based beliefs. A lot of trauma survivors will spend their time in distraction. And distraction looks different for different people. It could be hours watching TV, hours online, hours tidying, hours compulsively soothing themselves with particular behaviors. And all of this distraction is to take away from the internal dialogue. And the reoccurring thoughts are actually clues. And when there's a pervasive thought that keeps coming in, maybe you want to run away from it. Maybe it hurts your heart when it comes up, or it just makes you want to numb and distract yourself. To ask yourself, where did I learn that from? And an exercise I like to do with my clients, I actually do it in the first or second session pretty early on, is I give them a whole list of negative cognitions, and that's just a fancy word for negative I am beliefs. And I ask them to close their eyes and take 3 deep breaths. And what changes in their experience as they gaze down the list? And then, you know, some people have more than one, some people can hone in on one, and they might go, oh, when I look at the I'm unlovable, I get a tightness in my throat. And tightness in the throat is often the words you never got to say, or the sensation of choking back tears. Then I have them draw a horizontal line on a page. And on one side is where they were born, their birth year. On the other side is where we are today. And then I have them write down, like the headline of a newspaper, 3 to 5 times in their life they're made to feel that way. Just enough to pull the memory from the filing cabinet. And then they start to see the bite that fits the wound, you know, the initial wounding memory, all of the times it was pressed upon. And you can start to delineate yourself from your beliefs and where you learned them and the memories. And the unexamined history is doomed to repetition. So when we actually look back and we lean into the discomfort of looking back, we're doing so because when you have that ability to track your belief to the memories, to where it was born, and then you can start to critically assess it and question it. And the childlike interpretation of the event, when an adult is looking at it or two adults are looking at it, your childlike interpretation of the event can shift. Because children, you know, a lot of these old negative beliefs, they happen in childhood. And children have this propensity to blame themselves and take ownership for things that don't belong to them. And there's a theory that I really like, and you've probably heard me talk about it before. And it's Fairborn. And he was a Scottish psychiatrist in the 1940s. And he researched children that were being abused and neglected. And he was very curious, you know, why are they all blaming themselves? They all said, if I was better or if I was less than this, then I wouldn't be hit or I'd get what I needed. And he became curious of this accountability and this self-blaming narrative that they all had. And he came up with the theory, the moral defense against bad objects. So it has a religious lens because it was 1940s Scotland. But what the theory states is that when you're young, when you're a child, or if you're a prisoner of childhood, let's say, you know, you can't say this person's really negative. I'm going to take a break from them. And the bullies in the schoolyard and the antagonists at home are to be tolerated. And you can't come to voice about your needs, your boundaries, your requests, your self-advocacy, especially, you know, people in Ireland that grew up in the 1980s, 1990s. It may be slowly changing now. But, you know, when you can't change it, they take on this sense of accountability, this sense of owning it. And that creates a fallacy or an illusion of control that if I'm a better kid, then I'll be loved, I'll be lovable. And they do this because they have so little control over the world that if they can take ownership, then they can pretend that they have some ability to control the outcome. But that over accountability over an extended period of time is a perfect recipe for toxic shame. So a lot of the time when you're doing the work with clients, they go back to these very, you know, more like a minor debt by a thousand cuts, more subtle memories. And it was more about the frequency that that belief was reaffirmed and that story became real for them. And when you go into these memories, and there's a quote from Francine Shapiro I really like. She says, everybody has 10 to 20 memories in their life responsible for all of the pain. And processing each memory is like taking a log out of the fire. So as we take these logs out of the fire and process them and change the meaning of them, the story changes. So I think for clients, in terms of, you know, your question around self-awareness and what can they do for themselves, just becoming aware of your self story, the beliefs that underpin it, and even doing the map, it can be very enlightening. And then you, when you go back to the scene of that memory and you realize as a 5-year-old, as a 6-year-old, as a 7-year-old, you know, I was worthy of more, then it can really change, you know, the relationship you have with yourself.
Wow, Jill, there's so much in what you just said. Like, and I love that exercise. I think that's a very, very useful thing to have in our sort of toolkit to look at very simply the points in our lives that we associate with feeling unloved. And again, I think it's really important that you mentioned, you know, sometimes as Irish people, we can quickly default to, oh, like it wasn't that bad, or I didn't, so-and-so had it much worse, or, yeah. And as you mentioned there, you know, especially sort of 80s, 90s Ireland, the upbringing of families and family systems were a lot different than they are today. And it sort of leads me to a question that I guess you and I have discussed before, but do you, and I mean, I don't expect you to be the authority on this or anything, but I wanted to know your opinion on how, as a culture, especially as a culture that has a huge diaspora and has traveled around the world, and you know, we're everywhere, and we export a lot of goods from Ireland, including its people. Do you feel that we, you know, have a different mentality and approach to self-awareness than perhaps different cultural groups like Americans or different Europeans? Do you think that Irish people have a specific, or is that too generalized perhaps?
No, I actually think it's a great question. It's kind of like Carl Jung's The Collective Consciousness. And I think every country, actually even every city, has its own collective mentality or tribal mentality. And what I noticed from compassionately witnessing trauma survivors in, let's say, Ireland versus the US was I noticed a lot more depression in Ireland and more anxiety in the US. And, you know, the opposite of depression is expression. And when you're not allowed to express for a really long time and there's silence, secrecy and shame, the most adaptive thing you can do is numb out of your emotions. But we can't selectively numb out of our emotions. We either numb all of them or none of them. And when you're chronically numb for a really long time, this creates a depression. And I think that when you know that it's not safe to come to voice, or if you know you're not going to be heard, or if you know that you're not going to be received in a way that's going to be potentially healing or nourishing, that it would only inflame the wound rather than comfort it, you will become a smaller, more quieter version of yourself. So I did notice that more, but I also feel like Ireland has evolved a lot. And there's a massive amount of transgenerational trauma in Ireland. There's a huge amount of intrusion trauma. And when you're a nation that's just trying to survive, you're not focusing on parenting as a verb. You know, it was, you know, Ireland has gone through so much pain and so much trauma and so much intrusion and assault that as a nation, I think we're actually quite young in terms of meeting our physiological needs and moving towards security and social acceptance and then self-actualization. But the culture in Ireland around mindfulness and mental health, I think it has grown more in the last 10 years than it has in almost the entire history of Ireland. And I was actually reading a poem. I think it's from, somebody's probably going to write in and correct me. And if they do, I hope that you'll share it with me. It's called The Three Cauldrons. And it was written, I think, in the 1700s or the 1800s. And it's a kind of an old Irish poem. And what it's about is your three selves. And it's about you as you are today, your earlier self, your younger self, and then your higher consciousness. It could be your internal healing wisdom. It could be your higher self. But this was written a very long time ago, hundreds of years ago in Ireland. And I think there's a lot of ancient wisdom around healing that gets lost. And I feel like in Ireland now, they're rediscovering that and celebrating that. And it's so funny because if you look at the pinnacle of trauma research now, whether it's psychedelics or structural disassociation or parts work, it's actually giving a nod to all of the ancient wisdom of Buddhism, Irish mythology. And, you know, there is a lot of healing wisdom in Irish culture. I just think we forgot for a while and now we're coming back home to it again.
Oh, Jill, that's so beautiful. I that was just so eloquently put. And I get really excited to hear that because I think as an Irish person in America and here in New York, of course, it is such a competitive city and we often see the best of our people, you know, really making a name for themselves. And whenever we, as you sort of alluded to there about the opposite, I love that the opposite of depression is expression. And when, you know, Irish people are allowed to express themselves, they can achieve so much. And as a nation, when we tap into our history and our heritage and the Celtic mythology, healers have been a part of Irish history for a long time. And I think that we, as storytellers and great poets and artists, that it's when we can sort of separate our past and how we've dealt with emotion. And I like what you said about, you know, we've been intruded upon and learning now to be more expressive is just, it unlocks such potential for our small nation. And I wanted to ask you this as well, which relates to that monologue that I just gave you. Do you believe that
cultural groups can carry trauma from generations before us without knowing anything about it.
That's actually really interesting. And there's a book on that topic called Unsayable. And also there's some interesting epigenetic research that has been done. Women that were in their second trimester during 9/11, descendants of survivors of the Holocaust, that genetically speaking, you know, with the arousal of the amygdala, I'm sorry for using this jargon, that's the alarm system in the brain. That's the fight or flight component that causes hypervigilance, that it becomes adaptive for your offspring to have the same hypervigilance, hyper-orienting, fight or flight on edge, almost like the precursors or the, you know, what primes you to develop PTSD. And when the unborn child is in their mother's stomach and she's undergoing a lot of stress, that absolutely passes through, you know, with epigenetics, those hormones are turned on to ensure that, yes, this child will be agile and hypervigilant and have attention everywhere. And that will be very helpful to the child in this unsafe environment. But then there's, another side to transgenerational trauma, which is the storytelling component. And these falsehoods that get promulgated from one generation to another, whether they're fears or judgments or shame or core negative beliefs. And I think everyone in Ireland has had the experience of being around a table and a conversation comes up about somebody that's quote unquote suffering from their nerves. And there was very little understanding and compassion about the context behind that. And, you know, people weren't really asking, well, what was going on for them? And I wonder how they learned to keep themselves safe in that way. Or, you know, why is this person ritualistically, compulsively self-soothing with alcohol and trying to numb away the pain? I wonder what their core wound is. You know, those were not conversations that were happening, but I think they're happening now.
That's so good. So good for you to say that. And I agree, because I think especially in the last number of decades, even Ireland is still recovering from a very dark past and it's coming to light now, and survivors are speaking out in their droves and having that platform. And I think that when we look at our sort of generation and the generations coming behind us, we're so much more aware of the truth. And I think in truth, we find, although it might be hard to hear, it gives us, as you say, that we then have this understanding of why behaviors and why people have acted in a certain way. And as well, I think it's a really important part of forgiveness. And that, I think, is such a, when we surrender to that it helps both us and our relationships, especially in family systems, because that is probably our most complex system to be a part of, right?
Well, you're bringing up a huge topic in terms of forgiveness. And there's a quote from Nelson Mandela that I really like. And he says, resentment is like drinking poison, hoping the other person will die. Wow. And, you know, the grudges, the resentment, the hatred that you carry for people that hurt you in the past, it festers on the inside of you and it hurts you. And forgiveness isn't forgetting. Forgiveness isn't not having boundaries. Forgiveness isn't continuing to put your hand in the fire and getting burnt every time. Forgiveness can look very different according to the past and what it is that you're trying to consciously uncouple from. But it's a huge topic. And that unexpressed anger and resentment can be so hurtful and toxic and painful to carry on the inside. And working towards a place of forgiveness and resolution and reframing is not easy, but can be very cathartic.
That's so interesting. I think when we carry resentments, it eats away at us, and it affects often us more than it does the person that you resent or the thing that you resent or the experience, because we're carrying it and letting go of it. Especially in Ireland, we're conditioned not to complain or talk about those experiences. But yeah, when it comes to our self-development, you know, looking it in the eye, there's such a freedom to that.
It's very liberating to come to voice and, you know, keeping the secret on the inside, letting it burden and weigh you down, and then it transforms into resentment. It's hurting you even more. I do think that finding the safe space to come to voice and share it is so important. And as I'm telling you this, I'm actually thinking of one of my primary school Irish books. I forget what it was called. And it was someone that had a horrible secret and they felt really bad and they went to tell a tree. And then somebody cut down the tree, made it into a harp, and the harp told everyone in the village. And it was such a terrible story because it was very much like, you need to keep this secret and not tell anyone. But I felt like it was very symbolic of the time, you know, in that, you know, when you're hurt or when you're wounded, there's all these loyalty binds and all these challenges. And, you know, if you say this, you'll get someone else in trouble and or it could make things worse for you. Or you could be blamed for the pain, and that silence can feel very safe, like an old friend. But actually, it's the birthplace of trauma, is that silence and the secrecy and the shame that you keep within that festers in the inside and burdens you and eventually eclipses your sense of self. And, you know, the only antidote to that wound is, you know, finding safe spaces to tell stories where you'll be compassionately witnessed and the meaning can start to lift and transform.
Absolutely. And now, Jill, this is, I mean, I could honestly listen to you all day and talk about your methods and everything that you're saying. It's so enlightening. But I want to bring it back to New York. And I feel like with the work that you do, with being a parent, with constantly furthering your knowledge and expanding your practice and writing books and doing so much, how do you find balance? And I think it's something that we struggle with, any New Yorker struggles with, is finding balance. And I'm curious to know if you do, and if so, how?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And for a while, when I first moved to New York, I was actually very off balance. My internal dialogue was very much, I should, I must, I have to. And I became very much work-oriented, like a workhorse. And I forgot to be playful and to connect. And a couple of years ago, I kind of undertook a life review, which sounds very serious, but it wasn't really. It was, I think it happened on a yoga mat or on a walk or something casual like that. And I was thinking back at, you know, my life like it was a movie montage, and I was thinking about the best moments. And they were laughing with friends or having conversations or just having an adventure. And I was thinking, wow, I want to have more of that. And I was lucky because when you came into my life, I was very much, I'm going to say yes to everything. And I'm open to connection and novelty and fun. And then you just appeared. And we did the yoga teacher training together. And it was lovely. And it was, you know, it led to all kinds of great conversations and fun and laughter. And I just felt like making that agreement with myself that I'm going to be open and I'm going to say yes to new things and just, you know, be more present. And that is really the substance of life. And it's really hard to do that if you're burnt out, if you're in a stressful job, if you're in an abusive relationship, if you're eclipsed by the trauma of the past. You know, that may not be where your mind is going, but it could be part of your future template. And, you know, obviously from our time together, having cups of tea around the table and laughing in movement and yoga, having a goal that excites you and scares you at the same time. I think these are things we both share in terms of the joie de vivre and what keeps us going and what, you know, gives you balance. Because as you said, it's all about balance.
Oh, Jill, I'm so flattered. And I love that I just sprung up in your life when you were looking for someone.
At the perfect time. When the student is ready, the master appears. You came to me when I was ready.
But I love how much you always remind me that when we think with abundance, that abundance will flow. And I think that really, as you said there, the essence of life. It's for me, I had a moment, many moments with you in conversation. And actually, it was a year or two ago, I watched a video on Instagram, and it was just a conversation Oprah was having. And she said that when we live with intention, and it's such a simple concept, but when we live with intention, so that when we wake up, and I think it really flowed through our yoga learning together, that when we simply start to watch ourselves nearly from a height and live just with intention, like, why am I going to this job today? Or why am I doing this at the weekend? And when we align those things and when we notice what our behaviors are, and, you know, professionally, socially, in relationships, things start to sort of fall into place and we know where we want to go, you know, if we're ever at a bit of a junction. So I think that's a really important message that you've sent, that, you know, also not taking ourselves too seriously when we're in a city like New York, because it can be all encompassing and it can be very, very intense. And it's funny because I spoke to a guy recently who's a CEO of a very successful company, and he was struggling. He was opening up about how he's struggling to create content, right? Because sometimes it's hard to get the creative juices flowing when you're tired and yeah, overworked. And, you know, he told me that he finds that his best work is done, you know, sometimes on a beach and when he's, you know, on a holiday and or taking vacation. And I said, oh, have you gone anywhere this summer? And he said, no. And I said, well, that's your sign, you know.
Yeah. That, you know, playfulness and creativity go hand in hand. And when we're all work and we're no play and we become very rigid, it's really hard for us to have the inspiration or listen to those whispers of destiny or tune into our own intuition. And we become very, I should, I must, I have to, rather than I want, or wouldn't it be interesting if. And that time for play is not something adults often give themselves a chance to do. And, you know, the playfulness, the creativity, the spontaneity, and it's not really celebrated as it should be. I think also in Ireland, you know, in childhood, if you were bored, that was your fault. And there's always a job to do. And I need to find a way to play is kind of a pretty new concept. But when you go into the history of time and you think of people that had amazing epiphanies and ideas, they often did so in the context of play. These very small little moments where there was presentism and their mind was empty and it wasn't full of chatter and they were just in the moment and they were very open and receptive. And they just thought, wow, that's an interesting idea. I think I'm going to follow it with my energy and my focus and my optimism. So making time for that playfulness is, whether you're a CEO of a big company or whether you're a teenager studying for their junior cert who's really stressed, or whether you completely went down the rabbit hole and found yourself in a cubicle where you feel demoralized each day, those little opportunities for play are kind of the way out of I should, I must, I have to getting these little hints and these whispers of a life that would feel more fulfilling.
Wow, Jill, that is so powerful. What a powerful way to put it. Thank you so much. So I'm going to finish with my classic question for my New York guests, and very lighthearted. It's basically your top tips for navigating New York. So maybe one pointer or a couple of pointers that you find have helped you, like, logistically and emotionally navigate your life in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I did as a typical Cork person when I moved to New York was anyone I knew from Cork, I reached out to them, which is so small-minded. And I remember having a list and it was, you know, buy a new couch, clean the microwave, make friends. And I was like, perfect, made friends, done. But then, you know, you have to grow. You can't just be in an echo chamber where you're only hanging out with the people you met in Cork. And I think that putting yourself in uncomfortable situations and being very open. And what I actually did in New York is, one of the things I love about New York are some of the people that inspire me and the authors that I really follow. Everybody flies to New York and comes to New York and speaks and gives workshops and trainings. So I've actually been fortunate enough to, you know, see Oprah and Brian Wise and Gabrielle Bernstein and, you know, so many of these notable authors. They just kind of land on your doorstep. And when you're in those workshops or you're in those kind of, you know, day outings, you're in a room full of people that have the same passion and interest as you. And everybody probably has the same life values. And then just being open and receptive to the energy around you, you know, all that positive energy. And for me, New York really made me tap into what makes me feel, what do I read for fun? What makes me feel excited and optimistic? And then, you know, when I would see these amazing opportunities to indulge in my interests and my curiosity, when you're in the room, you see everyone else is there for the same reason. So I think that's really important. And the third thing is with discernment to say yes. You know, there's this balance of the duty of care versus the dignity of risk. And the duty of care is you don't want to burn yourself out and you don't want to be boundaryless. But the dignity of risk is wise risking. You know, challenge yourself, set a willpower challenge to say yes every so often to something that's outside of your comfort zone, or it scares you, or it's just totally not characteristic of you, but there's something about it that's very intriguing. And I think that that's what keeps life interesting.
Jill, they are such great answers, and I'm going to take them on board as well, especially you're so right about the workshops or like a book launch with somebody that you followed, because I think that what's typical of New York is that boundaries can often, people will just say hi and ask you who you are and what you're doing here. And it can be, I remember when I first got here, I was like, oh my God, like this is so aggressive. And yet in a way it means it leaves no opportunity not to connect with people who have the same interests or are like-minded. So that was such a great answer. And Jill, I just cannot thank you enough. I'm going to ask you now to tell our listeners where they can find you online.
So I like to share a lot of free resources and meditation techniques, journal prompts, kind of like the turning beliefs into memories one from earlier. And I'm on TikTok, I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under at Dr. Jillian O'Shea Brown. On Twitter, I'm Dr. O'Shea Brown. But if you Google my name, I come up pretty quickly because I think I'm the only one with this very long name. And I basically aim to be helpful, and I aim to share information that allows people to go within. So if you're curious about any of the resources, I just share a lot online, and a lot of the materials for my book I've actually posted online. So it's in little chunks and it's accessible, and it's something you could share with people that matter to you.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, Dr. Jillian O'Shea Brown, it has been an absolute honor to have you as a guest on Navigating New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just want to say again, I think this podcast is so important for celebrating Irish culture and telling people's stories in terms of not just where they are today, but how they got there and, you know, maybe how they got there from their darkest moments of self-doubt. And I just really love what you're doing, and I really appreciate what you're doing, and your optimism is infectious. So please keep going.
Oh, thank you so much, Jill.